It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, it is the singular David Sedaris. David writes and David is funny. The sideways take is his thing, like with family dinners.
Oh, God, I thought, as did everyone else at the table. For when it was dinner time and someone came calling, it was always our father who insisted on answering the door and on telling whoever it was very firmly that it was not a good idea to interrupt people while they were eating. But when that door was flung open, everyone on the other side of it wore the same expression. A startled, quizzical look that translated in that gentler, more polite time to, "Where are your pants, sir?"
David's dad always dined in a dress shirt and underpants. Stick around for more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. With over 7 million copies of his books in print, humorist and satirist David Sedaris looks at the sides of life that most of us would not even notice. Described by Publishers Weekly as Garrison Keillor's evil twin, he's a born storyteller. Now, many of us first met him with his now famous story about being a Christmas elf at Macy's. He's gone on to tell us tales about realizing he was gay, learning to speak French, his attraction to taxidermy, and to family dinners with his father, dining in underpants. Well, David's latest book is a collection of essays. Let's explore diabetes with owls. David, great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, David, this is the classic question I love to ask writers. What was it like at dinner with your family?
Well, I always considered myself very fortunate in that respect. Even when I was a child, I realized how fortunate I was. There were six children in my family, and, you know, my mother was a great cook, and we would all sit at the dinner table, and my dad would leave the second that he was finished. He would eat in his underpants, and then he would leave the second he was finished. And the rest of us would sit around the table for hours and hours and hours, and just laughing and talking, and there was no better place to be. There was no better place to be than around our table. And that was the case when I was in the first grade, and that was the case when I was in the seventh grade, mm-hmm. and that was the case when I was in high school, and when I came home for college, and for as long as we were all together, there was no finer place to be. I just, you know, remember watching those candles burn down, you know, the candles in the center of the table.
Right.
They would just be, you know, in time became like cigarette lighters, you know. At first they would light the cigarette for my mom, and then eventually they became cigarette lighters for everyone, and, you know, the room grew smokier and smokier. But it was just a wonderful place to be.
Well, just out of curiosity, why did your dad eat in his underpants?
Well, he just came home from work every day and just took his pants off, and then they were off until he went to work the next day. You know, it was the way that a woman might remove her high heels.
Mm-hmm.
But he just removed his trousers, like they were very confining. And sometimes we'd be eating and somebody would come to the door and we would think, oh, no. And he would answer the door in his underpants. And, you know, you just hope that it wasn't a friend of yours.
Better
it drove
a stranger.
Him crazy.
What about today? What's the dinner table like for you today?
Well, I've been with my boyfriend Hugh for 23 years.
Oh, my. You met when you were 12, right?
We met when I was 11, actually. We met. But he's a fantastic cook. He's happy to spend 4 hours a night making dinner. And what I like about him is that he's not a snob cook. Like, he doesn't judge other people's food. Like, if we're invited somewhere for dinner and the person prepares something that is, you know, even if it's really horrible, Hugh will eat it all. He never have a bad word to say about it. I think people who are confident in their ability can be generous that way.
Mm-hmm.
And for as long as I've known him, you know, when we eat dinner, there's always candles on the table. The table's always set. We're only allowed to eat dinner in front of the TV when the Academy Awards are on. That's the only time we're allowed to do it. Otherwise, you know, we're at the table just the way I grew up. And I, when I'm signing books, I'll ask people, I'll say, oh, did you have dinner yet? Or what are you going to do for dinner? And I'm appalled by the number of people who will say, oh, you know, I'll just eat a burrito in the car, or I'll just have some crackers. Mm-hmm. I need dinner to look forward to. Maybe because I quit drinking and I quit smoking. So all I really have to live for is dinner.
Do you and Hugh throw dinner parties?
You know, when you throw parties or something, sometimes it just doesn't work out. You know, you do all this work and then you have people over and it just doesn't take off for some reason. Mm-hmm. And afterwards you think, what was it? Who was it? Can we blame any one person in particular? Or was it the combination? If this person had been sitting at the other end of the table, would it have been better? You know, it's a chemistry project, really.
And it is chemistry. Someone once said to me, who was famous for giving parties, that the thing she worked hardest on was who sat next to who at the table.
But I think that's a luxury problem from the days of yore, really, because now I think a problem is, how do you even have a dinner party anymore? I mean, one person's lactose intolerant, another person can't eat wheat, someone's a vegetarian, someone's a pescatarian.
That's a good point.
You know, that was the thing I noticed in France. People eat stuff there. You know, you can actually have a dinner party. We've never had that problem in France.
What about England?
In England, it's more of a thing.
Complete change of subject. You wrote a great piece in The New Yorker about the Fitbit. Tell me about it.
Oh, yes. I got a Fitbit at the end of February, and I have a friend who has one, and she'll eat lunch while hula hooping. And sometimes she'll go to the Y 3 times a week. And so she was really involved with her Fitbit. And I immediately became super involved with my Fitbit. You know, it wants you to walk 10,000 steps, which is, for someone my height, like 4.2 miles. And once you do, it tingles, right? And then it emails you and it says, 10,000 steps, that's great. Do you think you can go 15? And I said, I think I can. And in no time at all, an average day when I'm home, I walk between 14 and 17 miles a day because of this damn Fitbit. A day. My peak, I mean, my highest so far is one day I walk 25 and a half miles.
Oh, my God. Okay, but doesn't this, you know, make Hugh's wonderful abilities at the table even more tempting?
Well, you know, it's great because if you've walked 25 and a half miles, you can pretty much eat whatever you want to.
Good point.
You know, because you just burned, I don't know. It tells you, the Fitbit tells you how many calories you've burned. So, yeah, if you walk 25 and a half miles, you can eat, you can have all the ice cream you want. But I've met a lot of people on this book tour, and they say, oh, I have a Fitbit, too, and I'm completely obsessed with it. And I say, well, I don't see it. And they say, well, I left it at home. Then don't say you're obsessed. I would never. Sometimes I charge it. You know, you have to recharge it.
Right.
And I'll put it back on to run to the bathroom because I don't want to miss those steps.
David, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
David Sedaris' latest book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Now, as an homage to David's British life, we thought you might appreciate a recipe for a British sweet from Nigella Lawson. Hokey Pokey. Take a look at it. It's at splendidtable.org. I'm about to make a bold statement, and not to insult dedicated locavores, but you all are not the pioneers. Today's reverence of the small, local, and unique places to eat really got a boost when Jane and Michael Stern hit the road in the early 70s. Clueless about what they were really taking on then, they innocently headed out with a map and a Volkswagen bus. They wanted to visit all the truck stops in America. And from there, they never looked back. Their first book, Road Food, was published in 1977, and it became a classic. Well, that Road Food is still a bestseller, and it's now in its 9th edition. Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Now, you two have updated the great classic Road Food once again. What's new in this edition? What's changed?
Well, there are 200 restaurants in the 2014 edition that were not in the previous one. And in addition to listing 200 new places, there are 900 altogether in the book. What we've done in this edition is something brand new, and that is create a road food honor roll, which is 100 of our really favorite, absolutely essential restaurants all around the country.
But I don't know that a lot of people know how this began. You know, it's worth telling the story. And the time that you started doing this was not a time when people were looking for this kind of food. Right?
You said it. I mean, when we wrote the very first edition of Road Food, which was published in 1978, the idea of writing an entire book about great regional food was kind of ludicrous. We had to really convince a publisher, I mean, really twist their arm to believe that indeed there was enough material to fill a guidebook about great regional food.
Don't forget, Lynn, at that point, the food people wanted to eat, so-called continental food. You know, this was the era of Julia Child, of all the, you know, the great French mm-hmm. chefs. And as, you know, when we said we want to write a book about American regional food, I mean, quite literally, people did not even know what we were talking about. And they said, what is that, hamburgers and hot dogs? And to be totally honest, we didn't really even know what it was ourselves. We got in the car and drove around for 3 years and kind of figured it out as we drove.
So now, okay, so is there some sort of sea change that you've seen with this new edition or over the past decade or so?
Oh, God, yes.
I think the big change is that America over the last 20, 30 years has really overcome what used to be a culinary inferiority complex. And that's important not only because people appreciate the food, but because the restaurateurs themselves appreciate that what they're doing is really preserving a national legacy, a heritage that's well worth preserving. You know, back in the day, if you ran a nice pizza place or barbecue place, you would hope that your kids would grow up and do something better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they still will. But now, you know, it's kind of honorable to be a great barbecuist in a
yes.
lot of places.
Yeah.
I think sometimes we feel like, I don't know, Bill Haley and the Comets or Chuck Berry, in that we kind of started all this and now the landscape is filled with 18 million people who, you know, are experts on American regional food. We're very happy that that it is so interesting. On the other hand, you know, we kind of feel pilgrimy about it, you know, that this is ours.
Well, and there is the issue, and this is a really interesting – we actually gave a talk a while back at the Midwest Culinary Alliance, and the title of the talk was, Will Success Spoil Regional Food?
Uh-huh.
And the issue there is, you know, when we discover a little out-of-the-way restaurant and write about it, generally – you know, our readers will go to it and maybe business will pick up a bit. But when that restaurant gets on TV and one of the TV celebrities, you know, touts its specialty,
mm-hmm.
that restaurant can change dramatically and not be the wonderful place it used to be.
The curse of success.
Yeah, and it's that double-sided thing, because that means people who have worked very, very hard, maybe for generations, are now finally maybe seeing a very large return for their work that will mean stability and, you know, for their families and for their employees. And yet, by the same token, the whole experience becomes something really different.
And there also are plenty of little hole in the walls that we are still discovering that can be our secret place for the next three decades.
Well, ours and our readers.
Yeah, you'll only tell us, right?
Right.
Yes.
Only tell you.
Okay. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye-bye, Len.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food and proprietors of roadfood.com. Well, coming up, fire up that Weber and grill up some bread. Yeah, bread. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Maybe you know him by his nickname, Blood Clot. John Joseph is a punk rock singer, probably most famous for his work with the Cro-Mags, and he's the author of the memoir, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon. An unapologetic vegan, his most recent work, the title of which I can't say on the air, but it roughly translates to meat is for wussies. Well, this book literally attacks the myth that men need meat to be fit and strong. Contributor Noel Carter talked to John about his unusual path.
John, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So I can just imagine fronting a punk rock band is no small feat. It's incredibly physical work, and I can just imagine the sort of toll that that takes on your body. How long have you been a vegan, and how did you come to embracing a plant-based diet?
Well, I actually started in late 80, early 81 is when I made the switch. And I actually really got into the raw food thing for a while in the beginning. I was actually working for one of the most famous punk rock bands of all time, the Bad Brains, and many of them in the band actually were vegetarian. And the sound man, J.W., the late J.W., rest in peace, Jay, was a raw foodist and educated me. And, you know, I just started applying what I was learning to my life. And I just saw, you know, I always ran. I would work out. I took up martial arts, boxed. And when I started adhering to a plant-based diet, I was recovering quicker. And also, it changed my consciousness in terms of I really paid attention to everything else in my life. You know, getting off drugs and alcohol. It was the catalyst for major change in my life. And, you know, people today say, oh, yeah, you know, you do the Cro-Mags to keep in shape for the Ironmans that I do. And I'm like, no, you got it backwards, homie. I do Ironman to keep in shape for the Cro-Mags. And if you've been to a Cro-Mag performance, then you really know what I'm talking about, because it's just energy nonstop for 1 hour straight.
That's amazing. You know, the book, it doesn't just talk about a plant-based diet and getting off of meat, but, I mean, you kind of, it encompasses the whole life thing. I mean, you talk about fitness, you talk about yoga, you talk about, you know, kind of rethinking things mentally. I mean, it's the whole package that you're really talking about here.
Absolutely. And, I mean, believe me, I'm not somebody wearing Birkenstocks and a tie-dye Grateful Dead shirt. I grew up, I was raised in abusive foster homes, boys' homes, orphanages, group homes. I was locked up. I did almost 2 years in, you know, one of the worst places in New York City and state, Spofford and then Lincolndale. So it's like, it wasn't coming from a place of being some weak type person. I was just searching for a way out of the madness. And when you go out into the universe and you're really searching, as they say, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And so many teachers came to my life and taught me. And that's why I always accept that I don't know it all and am always willing and trying to learn. So it's about paying forward the gifts that you get in life and helping the next person.
Yeah.
I try to be the example. I'm turning 52. I'm doing Ironmans. I'm never sick. You know, I basically live this lifestyle. So when people come out to the shows and they're like, how the hell are you doing this? I show them how, you know, and that's it. I'm not somebody on a soapbox that's going to go out there and start preaching veganism and this and that. It's just not my thing.
So, John, do you find much pleasure in the kitchen? I'm just trying to picture blood clot in the kitchen cooking, and I just want to know, do you love cooking and do you love eating?
I absolutely love it. And I have a certain tone. I like to have fun in the kitchen. It doesn't need to be this regimented, like, you know, uptight thing. And to me, cooking is meditation, man. Preparing all the food yourself, you know, it's just one of the great things that I really enjoy doing, and having friends over and cooking for them too, you know?
Well, John, I really want to thank you. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, as a matter of fact, and it was a pleasure.
John Joseph is the author of a book, the title of which can't be read on the air, but translates essentially as Meat is for Wussies. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Well, John left us with a recipe, and you can take a look at his almond flaxseed burger. It's all there for you at splendidtable.org. Here's a fun little fact. As humans evolved through the ages, we developed a smaller digestive tract and smaller mouths and teeth. And all this thanks to one thing, fire.
Now, recent research suggests that humans started cooking with fire nearly 2 million years ago, and that saved us hours of chewing each day, besides absorbing more nutrients. Drop a flat rock into that fire, and before you know it, you've got tortillas and pita and focaccia. Well, food historian and former archaeologist Paula Marcoux has written the book Cooking with Fire. Our correspondent Rebecca Shear got a lesson in harnessing fire to bake.
Hello, Paula Marcoux.
Hello, nice to be here.
So you are a food historian, but apropos to your book, I understand you also have experience as an archaeologist and a bread oven builder. How do you feel those two avocations informed your writing as you put this book together?
Well, it was through archaeology that I first got to travel and see people baking in ways that seemed amazing and strange to me, and also got to dig up baking installations that also were strange and unknowable. And it was as a baker that I began to mess with actually using different technologies and starting to build them and try to understand how people in other countries even today bake in unusual ways to us in the West, and also how people used to bake in some ways that are entirely gone by now.
So yeah, you talk about, in your section of the book called Cakes on the Griddle, you talk about how baking technologies developed to suit the grains available. They went hand in hand in terms of gluten and non-gluten. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, for the last 10,000 years or so, people have been developing wheat to have more and more gluten in it so that it behaved well for bakers. The types of diffusion of that baking technology was carried out by nomads who were carrying griddles across the deserts and plains with them. So they were baking flatbreads on these griddles. If they were traveling, they had no place for a big built oven installation, and so baking on a griddle was most suitable for their way of life. So these traveled all over the place, and that griddling technology went with wheat, and nice, stretchy, big flatbreads came along with that. But in places where they're colder and damper and wheat doesn't grow well, grains like rye and oats do much better on a griddle as a sort of a crunchy little flatbread like you might find in Scandinavia or an oatcake as you might find in Britain. A very different approach, and that's determined by the type of grain that's used in it. But all in all, it's the griddle, a very simple baking technology that makes it a flatbread.
Is there a particular kind of flatbread that you think people should try to cook on their griddle?
The simplest thing, and something people are already so familiar with, is pita. Once you start making pita at home, you will never, ever buy them again because they're easy to make and they're addictive to make. They're so much fun. Children can make them. And the flavor that you get when you're using high-quality wheat in it, whether it's whole wheat or white, just incomparable to the pita you can buy.
What makes them so fun to make?
Well, just the process of getting them to puff up is the addictive part. You just flip them back and forth a few times so that the pita forms a little bit of a crust on the outside, and that's enough to trap the steam inside and puff the sides apart. So it puffs up like a little beach ball on your griddle, and that is really a very compelling type of baking to do.
You have one recipe in your book. Well, you have tons of recipes, but one of the most fascinating ones, or fascinatingly named, I guess I should say, is the proto-historic multigrain flatbread.
Yes, that's kind of goofing on our other archaeologists and our propensity for long names for things. but it's given such a name because it's based on archaeology entirely. It's not very appetizing sounding, but it comes from artifacts that were found in cremation burials in Scandinavia. So these are basically corpses that have been burned, but with grave goods. And sometimes these grave goods included flatbreads, in fact, very often, as an offering with the dead person. So when things are burned, they're often partially burned or lightly carbonized, and that preserves grain extremely well. So archaeologists have been able to determine exactly the components and the shapes of these flatbreads, which I found entirely fascinating. So once I'd learned what types of grains they were made of, the types of fats that were in there, the shapes of the grains and the shapes of the flatbreads, there's nothing more to it. That's basically a recipe. So I picked out a few of my favorite combinations and made them, and turned out they were really delicious. They keep very well, and they're fun to make because you can leave a little hole in the middle and string them up, and they keep for ages. And that's how people in Scandinavia, that's how they used to keep their grain crop. If they kept the grain in its own natural state, it would tend to go moldy or get mildewy. But if they made it into bread right away and then strung it up in the roofs of their houses, it would keep for the entire season until the next harvest time.
So flatbreads, you know, as you say, they've become really universal. Can you give examples of the different kinds of flatbreads around the world?
Oh, it's really a staggering array. They diffused from central Turkey, from Anatolia, north, south, east, and west. And the same layering of bread with fat together that went eastwards to become what has come to us in Chinese restaurants as scallion pancakes went westward and was layered with fats in other ways to become everything from Italian pasta to borek in Slavic countries to back east again to the wonderful flatbreads of the subcontinent of India and Pakistan, South Asia, all the way to Indonesia and Malaysia. So all of these breads, they're fabulous array of flavors and textures, but they all come from one idea that just diffused over thousands of years. It's really not even known how long, but probably close to 10,000 years. The flatbreads of Scandinavia and so on may have developed entirely independently. The northwestern Europe having such a different grain tradition where these breads are really just lightly ground up grains mixed with some fat and some water, rolled out flat, and then baked on a stone, a hot stone that's heated up over a fire, coals, and then later on, only really quite recently after the Industrial Revolution, over an iron griddle. People in some parts of the British Isles still use baked stones, and there are still baked stones and literal stones used in Scandinavia for this purpose.
Well, Paula Marcoux, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Paula Marcoux is author of Cooking with Fire. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Now, Paula left us with recipes for that pita bread to get us started, as well as her proto-historic multigrain flatbread, which is delicious. Find them both at splendidtable.org. Ever tasted summer wheat beer with a young, creamy Stilton? You pair up an unexpected beer with an equally unexpected cheese, and you head into new taste territory. Cheesemonger Steve Jones of Portland's Cheese Bar has worked with cheese for about 20 years. He now collaborates with local breweries making cheese-friendly beers. Contributor Melissa Clark met with Steve to get some pairing advice.
So, Steve, when most people think about pairing cheese with a beverage, they automatically think wine. But you're espousing beer. Tell me about that.
I definitely think beer is the better beverage than wine for pairing with cheese for a couple of reasons. The effervescence will keep your palate lively, so the bubbles kind of keep scrubbing your palate, so you can taste more and longer. And also, it's a grain-based beverage, which cheese, obviously, the animals eat grains, too. So I think there's a very undeniable terroir between those two. If you taste a cheese and a beer together, the cheese will really pull up the grain bill in the beer, so you can really imagine the grains that the brewers have used. It really pulls out the different grains.
Most people don't think about the fact that cheeses are seasonal. You get some cheeses at some times of year, and same thing with beer. Is there a moment in the year that they both come together?
Well, I mean, summertime is great for a couple of reasons, one being all the animals have had the kids and the lambs and the calves, so their milk is back into cheese production. The animals are on really rich grasses, so you're getting these really beautiful summertime cheeses. And beer, you know, it's the summertime. Who doesn't want to drink beer when it's warm outside? So I think it's kind of a perfect time for beer and cheese to be together.
What are some of the other things that you consider when you're pairing beers and cheeses?
The three things I think about mainly are the regionality and then comparative or contrasting. So with comparative, I'll take a beer that's more tangy and acidic, and I'll pick a cheese that's got that same tanginess, like a goat cheese and a Saison, for example, where you've got both, you're playing off of those acidic notes on those. And then with the contrasting, more like an imperial stout with like a triple creme, where you're taking those big roasty notes and you're mellowing them out with a bigger, creamier notes.
And does it also work for, you talked about acidity in terms of like flavors. Will that also work with two big flavors? For example, imperial stout with a mild triple creme, but is there something that will stand up to it that will work?
Yeah, yeah. So the other way that I'd come at it with a really big flavor like that, I would put it up against like a blue cheese or something that's, you're matching, you're doing a comparative again where you're bringing the two big flavors to the table. With IPAs, people always want to pair IPAs and they're kind of difficult. You have to bring a big flavorful cheese like an aged cheddar or even a smoky blue sometimes will work really nice with that.
What are some of your favorite beer and cheese combinations, things that you know will work well?
My all-time favorite pairing is the Russian River Supplication with a really funky Camembert. And if you don't know that beer, it's a sour beer. And then the Camembert, it plays off of those funky notes really nicely. It's a perfect marriage. But other ones that I've really enjoyed, like I said, I do very much enjoy the Triple Crème and Imperial Stout. I think, you know, barley wine and Stilton is a classic match that I'd put up against port and Stilton any day.
And that's, again, the difference. You have the sweet and the salty.
Exactly, yeah. It's the potato chips and chocolate moment.
I know that you've also written about Weiss beers, which are perfect for summer, going well with Chev, with fresh.
Exactly. Weiss beers are fantastic with tangy Chev. So it's perfect for the warmer months, very refreshing and tangy. You can keep going back to them.
And then one of my favorite cheeses, I love aged cow milk cheese, you know, something like a Gruyere. What works well with something like that?
Sure. With mountain cheeses, I generally would recommend going with something a little maltier. Think possibly like a Doppelbock or even a more malty amber.
Mm-hmm.
That little bit of sweetness plays really nicely off of those kind of nutty notes that you get in mountain cheeses.
Now, when you're thinking about beer and cheese, is there any cheese that you just generally stay away from that's just not beer friendly?
You know, the hardest pairing always seems to be sheep's milk cheeses for some reason. They're always the one that we're scratching our head at the most. I always think, oh, Manchego is going to be great with this, and we try it, and it just quite often beer will accentuate the sheepy notes that you get in Manchego
or in a
sheep's milk cheese in general.
So you've got a sheep cheese. What are you going to pair with it? If not beer, what's your answer?
If not beer, I mean, the secret weapon out there that you know, is kind of the pink elephant in the room is cider. You know, cider is probably an even better pairing device than beer is. And you're seeing a lot of people kind of start to open their eyes to how great cider is.
And is this going to become the next beer and cheese thing? Are we going to see cider and beer pairings all over the country?
I think it's already starting. Yeah, the geeky factor is out there for sure.
Now, let's talk about structuring a beer and cheese tasting if someone wanted to do it at home. You'd want to start with lighter flavors and move into heavier flavors. So how would you set that up?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because you'll always say, you know, am I going to think about the beer first or the cheese first? Because you kind of have to pick the one and pick the gradation there. So, you know, you either go lightest beer to heaviest beer or lightest cheese to heaviest cheese. But in this situation, I would probably recommend just lean on the beer. So, yes, lightest to heaviest. And so, yeah, your lighter, brighter beers first. And then as you move up, you'll also move up in alcohol because alcohol can kind of trump your taste buds a bit.
So ending with the barley.
Exactly. Barley wines or imperial stouts or you know, double IPAs, you're going to put them at the end because those flavors are big. And the alcohol is, once again, another thing that's kind of hard to match against.
Steve, so great to talk to you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Steve Jones is proprietor of Portland's Cheese Bar. Melissa Clark is a food columnist for the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. Now, we're going to be back in a minute to talk with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You never call my name. Try and call your phone.
It is time to connect with you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. We've got Adam calling from New York City. Adam, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm so thrilled to be speaking with you.
I'm very flattered, Adam.
So I was calling because lately I've been buying a lot of canned artichokes, and I like to throw them on salads, but I really have no idea what else to do with them. So I was hoping you could help me out.
Okay. Are they coming in olive oil or are they in water?
I've been buying the ones in water.
Okay. Well, one of the things you can do with them is cut them into quarters, and you can marinate them for a couple of days in olive oil with a bit of salt and pepper and garlic and, you know, I'm a citrus rind person. If you listen to the show, I'm always using citrus rind.
Oh, yeah, so am I.
Yeah, and I love orange rind with something like that. And then you throw into that mix some olives, you know, really good-tasting olives, a bit of vinegar or fresh lemon juice, capers, roasted peppers, and you end up making this kind of marinated salad from it. And you can, the great thing about that salad is that it can sit in the fridge, you know, for a week, as long as you have a bit of acid in it. Okay.
Okay.
You don't want just olive oil. And then you let it come up to room temperature. And what you, one of the things that's fun to do with that is to out on the grill is to take some really chewy bread and grill it, rub it with garlic, put a little olive oil on it, and then serve slabs of that mounded with your artichoke and everything else salad. And it's just so sexy.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It's really fabulous, and it becomes a meal unto itself. It's sort of like a bastardized pizza. So that's one thing. I have a friend who used to cater, and she did a thing with the marinated artichoke hearts that were in olive oil. And if you made that salad and you added some tomato, it could be canned tomato, and you pureed it, and you'd use a lot of sweet red pepper, roasted red pepper, and a lot of tomato and the artichokes and the capers and whatever, but you puree it and you want it to be pink. That's why I use a lot of tomato. You get the most delicious dip.
Oh, wow.
But the marination is really the key because those canned artichoke hearts are very delicate and you want to give them a little, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And the other thing is you can pat them dry, you know, really pat them as dry as you can. And my grandmother used to do this and I'm trying to remember. I think what she did is she dipped them in egg and then she would roll them in fresh breadcrumbs and pan fry them. And I mean,
I never even thought about that.
Yeah, you have to get a lot of the liquid out of it, though. Otherwise, it's going to be spitting all over the place. But it was beaten egg and then fresh breadcrumbs that she would make, you know, in she would use just mincing and whatever, but we can use the food processor in a hot minute. And just an inch of oil in a shallow pan because you're going to just drop them in and roll them around a bit. And they're
crunchy. And you would do that with quartered hearts?
I would do it with halved hearts.
Halved, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then just stand back because everybody's going to want to eat them. But the real trick is pressing them to get the liquid out.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, but I do it with the salad idea. And you could change that. You know, if you could get the Middle Eastern spice sumac, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love sumac.
Imagine doing that marination with olive oil, lemon rind, fresh lemon juice, the sumac, and red onion. And you're in the Middle East.
Oh, that's – I can't wait. I'm going to go home tonight and try all of this.
Well, you've got me thinking
– the cans were on sale this week, so I have a ton of – my pantry's full of them.
Well, you enjoy the salads, okay?
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Adam, and thanks for a great call.
Bye-bye.
Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Elizabeth is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Elizabeth, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you?
I am good. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for asking. So in just a couple days, maybe in 5 days, I'm going to travel to Japan, to Tokyo, to visit family. Half Japanese and half New Yorkian. And so I want to, it's customary to bring gifts. I want to, whether or not it's custom. And typically for omiyage, you want to bring something edible.
And omiyage is what?
Omiyage, it's just like this culture of gift giving. So just like traveling or you're the traveler, you kind of come back with something.
I understand.
A little taste. And generally because, apartments there are a little bit smaller, it's nice to give something edible so it can kind of be enjoyed and then go away. So it's not like this, I don't know, awful cat sweatshirt that just lives there forever kind of thing. So I was trying to think of something that's, typically like New York or even American that would travel well and also be legal to travel, so like nothing,
right.
No seeds, no right. Cured meats kind of thing. And I was just wondering what you thought.
Oh, my. Okay. This all depends on the your family, obviously.
More or less. I don't see them as much as I'd like to.
All right. Okay. But whenever I would go to Italy, mm-hmm. I discovered that a lot of the people I knew there and I worked with there for a long period of time were nuts about maple syrup.
Interesting.
They were fascinated by it. They loved it. And I would bring maple syrup and I would bring a pancake mix,
genius.
Exactly. Because neither one of those things, mm-hmm. Were going to go bad or whatever. And when they felt like it, they could indulge. Another thing I used to love to bring were Bialys.
interesting. It's funny that you mentioned my father used to order a pizza the night before he would travel there, cut it up, wrap it in plastic wrap, and freeze it.
Don't laugh. That is exactly the kind of thing that is people just get excited over.
Yeah.
And it's like someone coming to us with some rare, delicate, or just everyday food of Japan that we are clueless about. And so I would say think Bialy. The pizza's a dynamite idea. Think something like pancakes, buckwheat cakes, This would be really interesting because considering that buckwheat does figure in Japanese culture. Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, here in America, we make pancakes out of them and the maple syrup. Think about the day-to-day stuff.
Right.
And that's what you focus on. I vote for the frozen pizza. I think it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And, whatever the hot pizzeria is in town, that's where you'll go and get it.
Wonder. Genius. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And have a fabulous trip.
Thank you.
Bye. Care. You too. The things that you bring to people, if you think about the everyday stuff you're eating, that's usually what another country is really curious about. In fact, I can remember a friend of mine when we were living in Belgium, a friend of mine was coming from the United States and she said, "What can I bring you?" And before I even knew it was coming out of my mouth, I said, "Sweet pickles." I hadn't had a decent sweet pickle in Europe since I had left the shores of the United States. She could have brought me caviar and I could have cared less. But those pickles, we polished off 3 jars in I think 3 days. Reach us. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or you can phone us. 800-537-5252. We do communicate by voice here. We've got Josh calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Josh, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I was calling because my fiance and I are having an engagement party, and in preparation for that, we wanted to serve some roasted meats that could be very well flavored and but could be cooked ahead of time and stored and possibly kept and then broken down for sandwiches or whatever at the day of the party.
Uh-huh, okay.
I wanted to get some advice from you about what are some of the good roasts that we can, season, flavor, roast in the oven, and then maybe store them for a couple days. And I wanted to, I guess my question is three-part, what are a couple good recipes for these oven-roasted meats? And mm-hmm. then what is the safest way to preserve or store these meats? And then and how long can I keep them so I don't compromise any of the flavor, quality, or safety of them?
I understand. By the way, congratulations on your engagement.
Oh, thank you.
This is the deal with roasting. Now, cold roasted meat or room temperature roasted meat can be fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
The thing you want to do, though, because first of all, you're going to be having to keep it cool. as you're serving it. You cannot let it come to room temperature and just sit out. And okay. So it should be in a on a chilled surface. You have maybe several platters set up that can be brought out, you know, one after another as one empties, because you don't want it all out at once and you don't want it sitting out there for an hour or two.
Okay.
So that's one thing you have to be aware of. And because things are served at room temperature or cool, you generally want to heighten the seasoning on them. And because especially if they tend to be on the cool side. Now, I think some of the best things that I think can be delicious when they're served cold is, for instance, pork tenderloin. Mm-hmm. So think pork tenderloin. Think a sirloin tip roast if you wish to have beef. Okay. And I would think of turkey thigh. Because, again, it's very juicy meat, really delicious meat. And it holds up really well cold, and it slices really nicely. Now, is there a particular theme to the meal?
Not really. We're going to have some old country terrines, a couple other items, maybe a little bit of seafood. But there's no particular theme that we've established. We're going to be, outside. It's going to be a little bit of an afternoon picnic kind of thing.
Oh, this sounds like it's going to be fabulous. Okay, so I think this is what you could do. Let's say for the pork, you want to brine it. Now, with the brine, you generally want for every quart of water, you want a quarter to a half a cup of coarse salt. So that would be something like kosher salt or coarse sea salt. Okay?
Right.
And then what you want to do, and the water should be stone cold. And you have to have a facility to keep these things really cold. I put them in plastic bags.
Okay.
And make sure they're sealed very well. I do double plastic bags. But what you want to do, let's say if you've got a quart of brine, all right, and you're going to do, you could do two tenderloins in that. You would want to have, in addition to that, you'd probably throw into that a half a cup of white wine. And if you want to be very European about this or very Italian, 10 cloves of garlic that you've smashed, about 8 branches of rosemary that you've pounded a bit to really get the flavor going.
Okay.
And you could pick any kind of flavor you want to go with that. You could do orange. You could do lemon. You could do tart cherries. You see where I'm going with this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And you let that pork sit in that mixture for about 6 or 8 hours because you brine by thickness.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pull that out, and now it's pickled.
Okay.
So it can wait a day in the fridge before you cook it.
Okay.
But as soon as things come out of the oven or out of the pan, you have some ice available where you can just, you know, put them on a piece of foil and get them into that ice, cool them down fast, and then wrap them very loosely. You want air circulating around them. Put them, then you can refrigerate, because what you want to make sure you do is they're going to continue cooking. And you always, you know, take meat out when it's about 5 degrees lower than the temperature you want it to be cooked to.
Okay.
Because it continues cooking. But the idea is you don't want to put a lot of hot meat in the fridge because it'll take forever for it to cool down.
Now, so when you say wrapped loosely, are you talking with like a muslin or a cheesecloth? Or
I use foil.
I
use foil.
And tin foil.
I use foil. And what I do is, this is just to get them cooled down. I just literally put them on the foil and maybe barely put it around it. I want to get as much cold air circulating as possible. Once it's really chilled, then I can seal it. Now, with something like the turkey, you could have some fun. You could go with a Mexican brine, you know, where you've got some really delicious chili combinations. You could do something on the order of ground almonds with a puree of roasted chilies. And, you know, you'd have a bit of oregano in there and you would have some garlic in there and that you just smear around that. And you can make that the sauce, by the way, too. Oh, I forgot to tell you, you always add, for whatever amount of salt you add, diminish that by a small amount and add sugar to the brine as well. So it's always salt, sugar, and water. That keeps it soft.
Okay. Now, could I use something like an agave?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. No problem at all. And then for the chicken, it might be fun to take that chicken and go to India or go to Morocco and, you know, look at those flavors. and, you know, take any direction that you want. But figure no more than a full day in the fridge.
Okay.
And slice cold. It's going to be much easier to slice things when they're stone cold. You can arrange them on platters, cover them, make sure they're sealed, and then have those platters ready to roll.
Okay.
And you can put little shot glasses or any kind of small glass, you know, on the tray between the platters so they can even stack if you have room in the fridge.
All right, great.
Yeah, this is where I always used to borrow people's refrigerators in the apartments next door.
Certainly.
Never anybody who lived upstairs or downstairs, but next door. Same floor. And congratulations to you both, and may you have a rip-roaring party.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You are welcome. You know, it's so tempting to do roasted things and have them cold in the summer. And it's great. It really is. But just remember something. Nothing spoils faster than animal protein. You want to keep it at 40 degrees internal temperature or below. That means you bring it out gradually from the fridge, unless you have some sort of chilled platter set up. Okay, enough food police. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Plato, who said, "Everything that deceives can be said to enchant." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Consider SplendidTable.org as your go-to source for great recipes, weekly e-newsletters, download our podcasts, and find information about anything you've heard here. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.